I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. We talk some Maryland politics this hour with longtime analyst Herb Smith, visiting us from McDaniel College. The Sun reports that on the final day of open enrollment for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, Maryland's troubled website slowed to a crawl, and all circuits were busy at the call center. What are the election year consequences of Maryland's experience with Obamacare? If, after all the pots and pans fall out of the closet, more people end up with health insurance and better health plans, will the first-year glitches make a difference to voters? Midday Politics with Herb Smith, after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us in WYPR out of Baltimore, WYPF Frederick in Hagerstown, WYPO Ocean City in the Eastern Shore, and streaming to you live online and offering podcasts of our show through WYPR.org. Talking some politics this hour, Maryland and national politics, with Herb Smith, professor of political science at McDaniel College, longtime observer of Maryland politics and author with John Willis of Maryland Politics and Government Democratic Dominance, a book published a couple of years ago by University of Nebraska Press. Herb, nice to have you back on the show.
It's great to be here, Dan.
I think this is an interesting day. This is the day after the official enrollment period for the first enrollment period of health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Lots of glitches and bumps along the way, both with the federal online marketplace for shopping for health insurance. And, of course, here in Maryland, Maryland had one of the worst rollouts in the country for in terms of the online marketplace. But here we are the day after this all was supposed to end. Lots of people still enrolling because of the extended deadlines for people who tried to enroll. The White House saying at least 7 million people may have enrolled by the time all this is over with, reaching pretty close to its target. In Maryland, below the target, but still nearly 300,000 people with health insurance through this system. That's both in Medicaid signups in the state and people buying private subsidized insurance. So, I mean, you look at it, you think back to all these glitches in October and coming forward. There's been a recovery both at the federal and state level. People have signed up. So my question would be for you and for our listeners this hour, what are the election? This is an election year, and there's another election year 2 years from now. What are the consequences, both in Maryland and nationally, considering the people's experience with Obamacare? And I said at the outset of the show in the introduction, if after all the pots and pans fall out of the closet, there's all that clanging noise, this big mess. But if after all that, more people end up with health insurance and better health plans, cheaper health plans, will these first-year glitches matter to make a difference to voters? So I know it's a hard thing to assess, but I wanted to hear from you about it. First, let's talk about the national picture of Obamacare generally.
Well, Obamacare is a good example of branding. You know, Americans polled, you know, a majority don't like Obamacare, but a majority like the features of the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. So it's a good example of how words matter in politics, yeah. Something I'm always preaching to my students.
That makes me wonder whether the White House should have embraced Obamacare. I mean, I was reluctant to use the term back in last year sometime. And then there were a couple of statements, I think it was Jay Carney or some other people at the White House, saying that they like that it's associated with the president that way.
But well, he actually did in the third presidential debate in 2012. But the point is, when you tie it to an individual politician, the program rises and falls in terms of the perception. You know, we don't call Social Security, Roosevelt care or
right.
anything like that. Right. So, you know, I think having some detachment is important to a public policy. In the long run, results matter, consequences matter. And people seem to forget that the motivation behind the ACA was the increasing percentage of the gross domestic product that was devoted to health care. We were hitting 16-17% as compared to, say, Canada or Germany or the UK that were at 8-10%. And it's a simple fact that economically you don't quite get the multiplier effect on spending for health care that you do in other areas. So really the steady increase in our national resource commitment to healthcare was unsustainable, and something had to be done. The result was the passage of the ACA.
And part of the reason those costs are so high was because of the uninsured, estimated to be about 50 million in the United States, in Maryland, 800,000.
Right. And their primary area for healthcare would be hospital ERs. And they couldn't pay for the treatment, and the cost was passed on by the hospitals to those who have health care insurance. And that was a constant cost inflator in the system before the ACA.
So along comes President Obama. He's elected 2008. We get Nancy Pelosi in on the act, and along with Harry Reid, we get the Affordable Care Act, which passes Congress without a single Republican vote.
And the interesting thing about that was, in contrast to the so-called Clinton Care of 1993-1994 that never came up for a vote, which was a top-down change, proposed change, in which Hillary Clinton and Ira Magazine are co-chaired the commission. They wrote the bill basically within the executive branch and passed it on to Congress. And even with Democratic majorities in both the House and Senate, it never came up for a vote, a colossal failure that fueled the Republican resurgence, congressional resurgence in 1994, and the Gingrich revolution. Thanks an awful lot for that.
So we get to the ACA, 2010, it passes.
It was more of a bottom-up affair.
Developed by Congress.
Developed by Congress with some presidential guidance, what have you. It was certainly tweaked by the White House. But essentially, it was, you know, part of this collaborative effort within the Congressional Democratic Party.
And also, we should note and remind people, a model based on Massachusetts system.
And originally based on the Heritage Foundation's response to Clinton Care,
right,
as the Republican conservative alternative to that.
And Massachusetts under Mitt Romney.
Yeah, Romney
right.
Care.
So we get here. It's 4 years later. The thing rolled out last October, and we're looking at these numbers today and saying, this isn't as bad as maybe it looked in October and November when the websites weren't working at all.
Well, that was truly unfortunate because it confirmed a conservative stereotype that government just flat out doesn't work. The Ronald Reagan. Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. You know, government, you know, from FDR on, it's been demonstrated time and time again that government, you know, with the right leadership, government counts and government can work competently and even efficiently and effectively. And this was, again, a short-term train wreck for both the Obama administration and for Democrats in general.
So what do you take away from it today? The government needed to step in and do something about the rising cost of health care in the United States, the rising number of people who did not have any kind of insurance, costing the rest of us. Government stepped in and did something, although it wasn't in a bipartisan manner. And then you had a technical glitch in the beginning, right? And now there seems to be recovery from it. So short-term train wreck, we'll get over it? Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, long-term probable success. We can't expect perfection in any human endeavor. It doesn't happen in the private sector. It doesn't happen in the public sector. We talk about the phrase close enough for government work.
Yeah.
Actually, it's close enough for, you know, General Motors work from what I'm reading about their recall.
That's right. All right, let's talk about Maryland a little bit. Now, we had a particularly bad experience with the online exchange here, and according to The Sun, it was still happening yesterday. The troubled website slowed to a crawl at some points yesterday. And, you know, this website problem has cost us more money, cost the federal and the state government more money. The state had to hire more personnel to manually enroll people in health insurance in Maryland. All circuits to the call center. The call center added like 200 more employees because of the problems. all this is very costly. So it isn't just that it was a mess at the beginning. It's over the term of this thing, it's going to be like $260 million in cost for a website that's probably going to be abandoned in the state of Maryland. Is this going to sink in with voters? Does any of this rub off on a particular gubernatorial candidate? A reminder that we have a June 24th primary in Maryland. Anthony Brown, who is the lieutenant governor of Maryland and was the administration's point man on the rollout of Obamacare here.
Well, he's still leading by 21 points, according to the last published Sun Papers poll. And the respondents were asked if the train wreck, the problems with the ACA rollout in Maryland would make them less likely to support the lieutenant governor, and 25% said less likely. Now, the interesting thing was that his closest rival, Attorney General Gansler, of course, was photographed in a teenage graduation party with red Solo cups held high. Mm-hmm. The presumption was that there was considerable teenage alcohol consumption there. That has proven a more damaging issue to the Attorney General's campaign than the ACA rollout, which is, it's a kind of interesting example of what connects with voters. And, underage drinking is more immediate. It's more within their experience bank than a $100 million rollout of a, complex federal program in the state of Maryland. There are other issues, too. And, one thing that I'm convinced is the cyber revolution. There's a disconnect between elected officials and what's happening with modern technology. I mean, Bill Clinton, John McCain, hadn't sent emails, in the 21st century.
Right.
And you kind of wonder if Lieutenant Governor and Brown, Governor O'Malley, are really that connected to that, to understand the difficulty in a highly complex operation such as the Maryland ACA site. Mm-hmm. From what I've read, and I'm certainly not an expert in this myself, but from what I've read, the state systems like Connecticut's and Kentucky that had the greatest success, followed the KISS principle of keeping it simple, stupid, of being the least complicated and just delivering on the fundamentals.
That's the impression I get from my reading of it, yeah.
And that's something that anyone with, public administrative experience would know. I think it's a telling comment that probably our most successful president since Abraham Lincoln was FDR. And he had 8 years of administrative experience as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. He knew how to pay attention to the significant details in implementation and administration, which was required mm-hmm. in this particular instance.
And so you're thinking there's some disconnect there or more trust than there should be on the part of, in Maryland, Governor O'Malley and Lieutenant Governor Brown?
Yeah, perhaps trusting the so-called experts and not bringing in second and third opinions.
That's interesting what you say that polls indicate about the public's perception of Brown and Gansler in regards to each of the, negatives on their resume. In Gansler's, it's that episode with his son and other teenagers celebrating high school graduation down on the shore with Brown. It's the rollout of Obamacare. You could say, okay, what should matter more to voters, really?
For a governor.
For a governor. So we could ask that question of our listeners today. If you want to, we'll throw that out to you. 410-662-8780. If you want to talk Maryland politics, national politics this hour, with Herb Smith. What should matter more when it comes to governance and evaluating or assessing who to vote for in the next election to make your next governor? Is it Brown's experience with Obamacare, Gansler's judgment and experience with his son and his high school graduation party?
With his son. I mean, I think that is the telling detail there. And, many more voters than I are prone to throw the first stone in that situation. Personally, I could not do that.
What, with Gantzler?
With Gantzler.
Yeah, my first reaction to that was somewhat sympathetic to Gantzler and the parents in that situation. Others much more harsher in their judgments, but we're, all are welcome here. All opinions are welcomed on Midday, 410-662-8780. Will Maryland's experience with Obamacare affect how you vote and who you vote for governor of Maryland? We have a primary coming up in June. And this is the question I'm getting all the time. Well, who do you think's winning? Who do you think's losing? What do you think of Heather Mazier? What do you think of
winning right now?
Yeah, undecided is the big group in Maryland right now. Anyway, we'd like to hear from our listeners. 410-662-8780. The Midday email address, midday@wypr.org. One other news item I want to mention today, Paul Ryan, Republican Paul Ryan, former candidate for Vice President of the United States, chairman of the House Budget Committee, has put out the Republican budget plan through the year 2024. Jonathan Weissman's story in the New York Times today. Representative Paul Ryan on Tuesday, today, will lay out a tough election year budget that purports to come into balance by 2024, in large part through steep cuts to Medicaid and food stamps and the full repeal of President Obama's health care law, just as millions begin to see its benefits. So a little bit more on this, and then we'll go to the phone lines, Herb. That's why I think it's an interesting day. Republicans are going to use this. They're going to pound away on Obamacare, continue to pound away. They did for 4 years. They're going to say it's hurting the economy, it's hurting the nation, even as millions, 7 million people sign up through this enrollment period, more through Medicaid coming and Medicaid expansion, and probably more signups in the coming year.
Well, 3 million kids under 26 have stayed on their parents' health care.
Right.
You know, tens of millions of people have gotten free physicals and flu shots mandated by the ACA. You know, this is pure symbolic politics. I mean, the Republican majority in the House of Representatives has voted over 50 times in the last 2 years to repeal Obamacare. It really doesn't have any meaningful effect.
All right, what happens if the Senate goes Republican in the November election, which is what some people are predicting?
Well, Nate Silver, who is the elections guru, who called every state perfectly in 2012, is predicting that at this time.
What if that happens?
Well, then the repeal of Obamacare could well pass, although one would think there would be a filibuster in the Senate. Democrats can do it just as well as Republicans. But even if it does pass, the president vetoes it. Will there be a two-thirds Republican majority in both houses? That I doubt.
All right, here's one more question for you on this, and we'll go to the phone lines.
Yeah.
If the Senate goes Republican and there are votes to repeal Obamacare, and the public continues to hear this argument that Obamacare needs to be repealed, that can get pretty old pretty fast. Even for people who were on the fence about Obamacare or opposed to it in 2010, this will be 4 or 5 years down the line now.
Well, one reason Republicans so intensely opposed Clinton Care back in 93 and 94 was that the prediction was that there was another major social welfare program. These things develop constituencies. I mean, you know, consider Medicare, consider Social Security. And once you have multi-million person constituencies, they're awfully hard to dislodge, and people begin to perceive who their enemies are.
So that could become really a tiresome debate.
Absolutely.
For people, especially if you signed up for health care, never had health insurance before. Never had a decent health plan before or one that you could afford. 410-662-8780. We'll go back and talk about Maryland politics with our listeners or national politics, whatever you like in this hour, with Herb Smith, professor of political science at McDaniel College and a longtime observer of Maryland politics here and analyst. Kathy in Catonsville, thank you for calling. We'll go to you. Hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
To say that I care more about underage drinking rather than a huge, you know, program, the online health website, is really overly simplistic. What happened with Gantzler kind of confirmed what I thought about him, which is that he's a hothead with questionable judgment. So, you know, Brown, I mean, maybe he messed up on the website. The national website is having trouble, too. Overall, it's a good program. I'm going to give him more of the benefit of the doubt.
Hey, I have a question for you, Kathy, before you go. What about that incident involving the teenage celebration on the shore revealed Gansler to be a hothead to you? What about that?
You know, I guess I've heard him on your program, and to me, he doesn't act gubernatorial, okay? And so, therefore, when I've heard him, I've thought, okay, I'm gonna get more information about him. I'll think about him. And I guess, boy, I guess that was a beautiful picture of him at that party. I guess it really leaned me the other way.
Okay.
Well, I mean, the photograph was very graphic, but I think also for some, this was the second shoe dropping. I mean, the first one was the story about a month before that about his, you know, somewhat misuse of executive privilege of with a state trooper driving the car and, right, you know, skirting around accidents
revealing himself to be an impatient person who wanted a state trooper to drive on the shoulder to get around
right.
traffic.
And apparently it was the state trooper contingent that dropped the dime on that one. And it takes a lot for a Maryland state trooper to drop a dime on the attorney general.
Yeah.
So
good point. Yeah. Good point. I was going to mention to our listeners, and I should mention, that on Thursday at noon, Attorney General Gansler, candidate for governor of Maryland, will be our guest here for a full hour, and you'll get a chance to call in and ask him questions. You were going to say something earlier about the gender breakdown from the poll. Now, this is a Sun poll from February.
Right.
I wanted to mention that Democrats in this poll, 40% undecided about the gubernatorial election, and over on the Republican side, 68% undecided. This is a poll conducted February 15th or published in the Sun February 15th?
Published in the Sun February
15th.
So it's early February.
Yeah, okay. So it's a couple months now. So,
but I don't think much has changed.
No? Okay.
You know,
what was the gender breakdown on the Gansler issue?
Well, the gender breakdown is that women were much more likely to regard the Gansler teenage drinking thing as a major deficit to the Gansler candidacy.
Interesting. Let's hear from another woman, Jean in Baltimore. Thank you for calling Midday.
Well, I hate to be stereotypical.
Sorry.
I think part of it, though, is, and I was talking with some of us the other day, and to make a reference like Chris Christie, and the whole traffic thing there, it's like on one hand, you're willing to have people in your agency working with you closely who don't have qualms about doing something like that. And with Gansler, you have, you know, whether it was his son doing the drinking, which is actually legal, or whether it was him sponsoring a party, there's an attitude about underage drinking, which is a significant problem, and then by extension, underage drinking and driving, that just belies a disrespect for the law and a kind of a sense of the law is for other people and not for me and mine.
Right. Well, there's a gender gap there. You don't, you know, you hear the expression boys will be boys, but you don't hear that, you know, girls will be girls.
Right.
And in, you know, adolescent men, I mean, the idea of doing something illegal during those teenage years, you know, among guys, the incident rate is pretty high in terms of self-reportage in public opinion polling. Among women, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a real behavioral differential there, and it's showing up in that question of whether you're more likely or less likely to support Doug Gansler because of this incident.
In the column that I wrote about this after the Sun published that photograph and stories about Gansler and in the teen party, a couple of people wrote to me and said they thought I had pulled my punch on him. But I, you know, you sit down and you think about things and you think about other parents. And these were pretty privileged kids, pretty privileged parents who could afford to rent a beach house and try to control the thing that we know that happens on the shore.
And have rotating chaperones, right, and the attorney general is one.
Other people said, you know, my kids would never do something like that. I wouldn't let my kids do something like that. And, okay, maybe you can keep your kid at home after graduation and forbid your son or daughter from taking part in those things. But I saw it as parents trying to keep their kids from getting killed, basically. I mean, because this is tragically is something that happens during that week after graduation, mostly related to drinking.
Of so keeping
that
it
was my in, that was my take on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and keeping it in confined space. You know?
Let's hear from Chris in Baltimore. You're up next. You're on Midday Politics. Hi.
Good afternoon, Danny, to your guests.
Sure.
I just kind of consider myself Joe Voter, where I try to do some research where I can, and then I listen to these shows. Doug Gansler, as far as being the state's attorney, the attorney general, I just kind of question some of the things that it seems fairly. It seems that his judgment in some of these areas as the state's attorney, I just question that. Now, as far as this health care issue going on now, I understand that Lieutenant Governor Brown was to run the program as the lieutenant governor, but it seems to me that if the program was for the benefit of the people, you would want to bring in, if not have run the program, you would want to bring in people who have experience with it. And Delegate Mazzia, it seems that she has extensive experience with it, having worked in or around it under John Kerry. So I'm looking for not political positioning or pandering, but I'm looking for cooperation. I'm just trying to see who is going to put the people first in this whole thing.
Hmm.
I would like to hear more from, when we're talking about health care in particular, I would like to hear more from Delegate Mazzia because of her particular experience on this. I noticed she has put out a platform on it, and I like what I read, but I haven't heard much from other people. I would just, as we go through issues, I guess I want to look for the ones experienced in those issues, and that's why I'm kind of disappointed with Doug Gansler, because in areas where his position experienced would expect him to act a certain way, he's kind of fallen short.
I get you, Chris. Thank you very much for the call. Interesting. The question of Heather Mazzia comes up usually in this conversation, too. I mean, she's behind in the polls. She's behind in money raising. A lot of people like her, or the folks who are undecided are at least giving her some consideration. And Herb, considering the very liberal policies that she's outlined, I guess I'm a little surprised that people are even talking about her. But this is a different age we live in now, right?
Yeah.
Times have changed, man.
I mean, you look at the referendums in Maryland in 2012, and you recognize that there's growth potential there for Delegate Mazzia.
Yeah.
You know, the early line in Annapolis on her chances was, you know, she'd carry Tacoma Park and Charles Village,
right.
and that would be about it.
Right.
That she was the fringe candidate.
Right.
But then, you know, what was...
Maybe Dickieville, maybe. Okay,
particularly interesting.
Yeah.
We do lean left there.
Okay, go ahead.
But particularly interesting was she was endorsed this summer, first major political endorsement by Mary Pat Clark, who is nobody's fool, and who saw, you know, potential there. And, you know, she swung for the fences in terms of the marijuana legalization. And the interesting thing
about... Tied it to pre-K education.
Tied it to pre-K education. Education is always a winning issue in Maryland.
Using the revenues from
right.
sales of marijuana to fund pre-K expansion.
Which Colorado would seem to demonstrate is, you know, just enormous revenue generator.
Yeah.
And has elevated herself from, you know, a kind of fringe candidacy. She's 4 points behind Gansler. Gansler is going to have to deal with the alcohol thing forever. It could be a mortal wound. When you look at it, 47% said, you know, it would make them less likely to vote for him. Only 42% said no effect.
Hmm.
Those are big, big numbers.
Let's take another call. Herb,
sure.
This is Kathy on the subject of Heather Mazzia. Kathy, you're on Midday. Hi.
Hi. This is a really interesting conversation, and I just want to say why I support Heather Mazzia related to health care and just in general. In terms of health care, as Herb pointed out, she has a track record in health care. I think actually a caller mentioned it. Not only with John Kerry's office, but here in the state of Maryland, she also was a sponsor of a winning bill that helped to have more children get health care coverage. I think it was 50,000 children. And when the numbers weren't as high as she wanted, she helped innovatively to figure out a way to reach more children and get to the goal. The reason I think she'd make a wonderful governor is that she's very concrete about her policies and not afraid to say what she thinks. I also think it's fair to say that Lieutenant Governor Brown never really apologized to the people, nor did Governor O'Malley, to say, you know, we're really sorry that this happened. Here's why it happened. And to add insult to injury, they pushed the investigation to 2015, which means that factual information can't even really come into the 2014 race.
Questions about the rollout of the development of the website and its rollout. And in point of fact, I think a legislator at a hearing asked Lieutenant Governor Brown if he felt the need to apologize for the rollout, and he didn't. He deferred. He didn't do that. And coming up right behind him was the Secretary of Health, Joshua Sharfstein, who did apologize. So, you know, in contrast, Lieutenant Governor Brown didn't look so hot that day. Thank you for your comments. I'd like to hear more from our listeners on this. Rob in Timonium, we'll go to you next, Midday Politics. Hi.
Hi, gentlemen. Just a quick question. You picking up on a caller that you had a little bit ago, she seemed like it was a bad thing or a disqualifier being a little hot-headed and being governor. But, you know, we've had specifically in the state... do you think Don Schaefer was a cool-headed mayor?
Good point.
I mean, you know,
well,
maybe she
wouldn't have voted for him. Maybe, yeah.
I mean, people are a little too fragile. It almost sounds like she had a list of campaign talking points there. That, and that's fine too. But you know, Lyndon Johnson. I mean, you know, do you think he was a cool-headed speaker and president, and Teddy Roosevelt for that matter? And you know, I just don't think that it's a disqualifier for being, you know, governor of a very big corporation. That's all.
Thank you. Excellent point.
Good point.
Harkening back to William Donald Schaefer, who I think in 1983 as mayor, when his temperament was well known, got 83% of the vote in the city in the Democratic primary, and then won two elections and was upset in the second gubernatorial election that he only got 60% of the vote. Yeah.
Well, as the late, great Richard Ben Kramer called him, you know, Mayor Annoyed.
Mayor Annoyed. We'll take a break here. Herb Smith is with us talking Midday Politics. Questions for you. What are the election year consequences of Maryland's experience with Obamacare? Do you think any of the glitches will affect how voters vote in the June 24th primary when it comes to the gubernatorial election? And what do you think this means for the future here in the United States? Obamacare, with a bumpy start back in October, now some 7 million people signed up, more to come. Can the Republicans continue to try to repeal the Affordable Care Act without some political consequence to them? 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. Critics of Common Core standards in education, these new standards that are being put into place, continue to make that an issue. The governor of Indiana on Monday signed a new, this is last week, signed a repeal of the state's involvement in that. He signed a legislation that makes Indiana the first state to opt out of Common Core standards. And there's been a lot of conservative outrage about this. Kimberly, this is her issue. She writes to us to say that as a Maryland resident, what matters most to me in voting for governor is not so much the glitches in the healthcare sign-up process, but the millions of more spent to completely replace the curriculum in our already top-rated school system with an untested, unresearched curriculum. This is a reference here to Common Core. I don't know where that one sits, Herb. I mean, they keep making an issue out of this, but it's going forward. You know, there's sample testing already being done. Teachers and principals have been taking classes to become indoctrinated to it. So, I don't know.
I mean, the education establishment in this country has, you know, once momentum starts, it's almost
it's
unstoppable.
Hard to stop. Yeah.
And it's not untested.
But is this not untested? No. But this is one of those top-down things that people resent.
Yeah.
Overreach by the federal government.
It started at the state level, really.
With governors.
I mean, the governors, you know, and again, they're influenced by their state superintendents and that kind of thing. I mean, this you know, percolated from the middle to the top.
They wanted a common standard in math, science,
which, again,
education.
You know, who initiated the common standards? George W. Bush with No Child Left Behind.
That's right. What did you want to say? Well, actually, what I wanted to ask you about, this is April 1st, Right. Happy April Fool's Day, by the way.
Politics is a suitable topic for April 1st.
But let's see. So we have this early primary. This is new to even you, Herb Smith. June 24th state primary, governor, attorney general, all the districts, the delegates, and the senators. So let's see. Brown, Gansler. Heather Mazier. Let's look at the Democratic side.
This is uncharted territory. I mean, this throws all political analysis off, you know, simply because, one, the vast bulk of voters have been trying to survive winter. I mean, that's been the major issue in their
and
life.
Pay our bills.
Not who's going to be the next governor of the state of Maryland.
And pay the energy bills.
And pay, you know, we hit an all-time record 2 months ago in our household. You got a June 24th primary that people aren't used to. Many of our public school systems, the kids are going to be in classrooms at least up till June 23rd. So you're going to, families with kids are still going to be concerned about school. Breaking through all of those day-to-day concerns and anxieties of the average Maryland family is going to be a monumental task for these campaigns. You know, for Lieutenant Governor Brown, the primary is still his to lose. He's, you know, basically sitting on a lead, trying to avoid mistakes, raising money and collecting endorsements. He did a very interesting thing a couple of weeks ago. He complimented Delegate Mazur on her bill to decriminalize marijuana.
I saw that.
And, you know, tactically, that was fascinating. And since Mazur and Gansler both come from Montgomery County, the most vote-rich subdivision in the state, you know, dividing that up between the two, it makes good tactical sense for the Brown candidacy.
What about Gansler? How does he overcome this thing that we've been talking about this hour? Going back to last year and the teen party.
Pay no attention to the kids with solo cups.
I mean, just ignore the issue.
There's no way
he's
of getting
be asked
around
about
it.
He may be asked about it on this show Thursday.
There's
noon.
No way of getting around it. It's there. When you think about
What do you mean pay no attention? What do you said paying no attention to the kids with the red solo cups? I mean,
he can't. It's hard for him to address that directly. And we've all seen, again, for politicians to admit they've made mistakes, it doesn't play either for Republicans or Democrats.
But he's going to be asked about it.
I don't know what his response has been in the past of that, but this is something, this could well be a mortal wound for him, and his boat can be taking water on very rapidly.
A comment on that by email from one of our listeners, Elaine, who says it appears that Attorney General Gansler has a do as I say, not as I do mentality from that case. Case in point is the Red Solo Cup and the state trooper incident. The rest of us, normal working stiffs, can't afford to rent a party beach house or a driver. This behavior sticks in my craw. But then again, it's the same story over and over again in Maryland, where cronyism is king and where parole violators and drunk boating convicts get court rulings in their favor that allow them to run for public office. Thank you, Elaine. Let's go to the phone lines, hear from some more of our listeners. Leah in Baltimore County, thank you very much for calling. Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I wish the media would pay more attention to all the candidates, because if everyone is candidate except Gansler and the lieutenant governor, I probably won't even bother to vote. Now, as far as Heather Mazur is concerned, I didn't know until just this program that her big thing is decriminalization of marijuana. If that's true, why is that any worse than the head legal officer who doesn't even enforce the laws against alcohol that are on the books?
All right, Leah, I made your point with that. Heather Mazur has been on our show. Anthony Brown has been on our show. We'll have Douglas Gansler on our show Thursday, and then we'll ask back all the candidates again before the June primary to see if we can get them all on the show another time. As for Republican candidates, we have had Ron George on, Larry Hogan has been on the show, David Craig has been on the show, Charles Lawler has been on the show. So Herb, I think our senior producer, Nikki Gamer, and producer Jonathan Ahrens covered all our bases on the GOP side.
Absolutely. I mean, the interesting thing there.
We can ask them back as well. But what do you want to say about the GOP side of this?
You know, for the Republicans, I mean, this one is even more up in the air. 68% don't know who they're going to vote for. Hogan's ahead with only 13%. David Craig second with 7%. But you have to, you know, there are two things to look at in terms of Republicans in the state of Maryland. One, it's difficult to win statewide, but it's not impossible. Bob Ehrlich proved that. In the last five gubernatorial races in the state of Maryland, Republicans have gotten 47% of the vote. Now, they've only won one, which is why Democrats dominate. But it's not a monopoly. Mm-hmm. In the last two open seat governor races, that's going back to 1994 and 2002, you know, in 1994, Republican candidate Ellen Saubry came within a whisker of winning. She lost by 5,900 votes. And, of course, in 2002, Bob Ehrlich won by 55,000 votes. So even though Democrats outnumber Republicans by over a million registered voters, it's not mission impossible if you get a divisive Democratic primary, which this one could shape up well to be, because, you know, Gansler is attacking Brown in terms of the ACA rollout in the state. And you have an issue like taxes, and you have a good Republican candidate. So it's up for to the Republican primary voters to select who that good Republican candidate will be.
A Republican who presents a moderate voice and doesn't harp on Obamacare being needing to be repealed.
A moderate, pragmatic Republican, you know, could stand a certain, you know, puncher's chance in this election.
Let's go to Stuart in Lutherville and take his call next year on Midday Politics. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Enjoy the show. Two comments. One is the Doug Gansler issue. I know it's been repeated often, but I'm concerned about his lack of judgment with the not only the drinking issue, but the traffic incident. And if you will recall, I believe there was a fellow named Mr. Corzine who had a similar issue in New York, driving over the speed limit.
New Jersey.
And when he became the CEO of MF Global, I think it was, mm-hmm. People lost several billion dollars. And so I question the future CEO of Maryland with this kind of judgment. The second is Lieutenant Brown. I was very excited a year before the rollout of the Affordable Care Act health care exchange when I heard him speak. Very impressive man, served our country, very articulate, and was saying how Maryland was going to be in the forefront. And then when this fiasco happened, I really did not see him take the front lead in terms of damage control, taking the lead and getting it fixed. And so, again, looking at a future CEO where they're always having to think ahead with problems and manage when things don't go well, he failed in my mind. I'm not sure what I'm going to choose as a governor moving forward, but I am going to be listening to what the Republican, even though I'm a registered Democrat, what the Republican has to say, because there's too much at stake to have a CEO of this state who cannot execute and a good judgment or execute problem solving, at
Stuart,
least in a public format.
Stuart, thank you. I appreciate your closing comments in this hour of the show. The show is not done, but that's sort of we're finished with politics for now. But Herb, sit here with me, would you? Paul Sullivan is with us from Sully Baseball.
Oh, absolutely.
He's a baseball pundit. And I wanted to spend a few minutes today because it's the day after opening day. It was a grand day at Camden Yards. Beautiful weather, finally. The Orioles play the Red Sox. They beat the Red Sox 2-1. Great way to open the 2014 season. So, and Sully likes the Orioles. He likes the Red Sox. He loves baseball. Hello, Sully. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm a. By the way, you made a mistake there. They did not beat the Red Sox. They beat the defending world champions.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah. Well, I
but for
enjoyed
Orioles
the game.
Fans, the magic number is 162 to clinch the division. So I think it's weird to say this, but that was actually a big win for the Orioles. To win a game against the Red Sox head-to-head, those games count just as much now as they do later, mm-hmm. head-to-head with John Lester pitching, and he pitched a wonderful game, mm-hmm. and without Manny Machado in the lineup, and they still pulled out a win. These are the games you want to put in the bank right now if you're a Baltimore fan, and it sounds bizarre, and it sounds like I'm making a joke, but that was actually a big win for Baltimore. Very, very well played game and a good win for the Orioles.
I agree with you. I thought it was really interesting to see the way Showalter managed the pitchers yesterday in particular, and then Tommy Hunter coming in to close it down after beaning the first, not beaning, but hitting on the shoulder, Middlebrooks with his the leadoff batter in the ninth inning, and we all kind of groaned when that happened, but he came back strong with a couple of nice strikeouts.
Well, it's funny that the best thing that happened to the Orioles this offseason, and you got a glimpse of it yesterday, was that Jim Johnson's now with the A's.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim Johnson, of course, came in the ninth inning and did what he always does, which is he let up runs in the ninth inning. And the A's lost that game.
Oh,
I think giving Showalter this kind of bullpen, instead of saying, well, I got to give it to Johnson because he's my closer, a bullpen that he can mix and match and bring in the right people and everything like that, I think there's going to be addition from subtraction taking out Johnson. And bring in whether it's Meek or Hunter or all the different pitchers he brought out yesterday, I thought he did a very good job mixing and matching. And I think this is the kind of bullpen that a manager who loves to overthink like Showalter should love, a bullpen like this where he could mix and match. And he did a fine job. I mean, the Red Sox stranded like 48 runners yesterday, which I don't think is mathematically possible, but sure felt like it. And there's sometimes they had five guys on base and they couldn't score any of them. And he managed to, you know, push all the right buttons. And it was, I'm not kidding, it was a really good game. And Nelson Cruz, who they signed, I think, hours before opening day, gets the big home run. This is an interesting Orioles team going into this season.
All right, Sully, we got 3 minutes here. I want to hear from you on the rest of the division, because we're so focused here on the Orioles, at least I am. I haven't really been paying that much attention to the Yankees, Toronto, Tampa, and the Red Sox that much. So would you size up the rest of the East for us?
Rest of the East. I think that Tampa has the best pitching and the smartest manager, and I always err on the side of that. A lot of things went the Red Sox way last year. Now, granted, they had a lot of injuries, but a lot of things went the Red Sox way. They all can't break their way again like this. I think they'll be good. Toronto, I think, is a mess, quite frankly. The Orioles could bounce either way. And the Yankees, look, at all the Yankees have going for them really is their uniform. Their infield is literally an Abbott and Costello routine, where you're like, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third. I mean, it is an old-timer's day in the infield for the Yankees, and I think they're going to have a step back. I think that the Orioles have as good a shot as any because their pitching could bounce one way or the other. I think Tampa, even though the Red Sox are the defending world champions, and as a native New Englander, I will preface every sentence I say this year with that statement, I think Tampa's pitching just frightens me. And their bats are not terrible. And so I would lean that Tampa has the best team in terms of on paper. But if the pitching holds up and Machado comes back, Baltimore has as good a shot as any. I mean, they were one bad September away from being a playoff team last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're right. Sully, I enjoy it when you hook up with us here on the midday show. So let's do this again from time to time, more than we did last year.
But try not to have it be after the Orioles beat the Red Sox every single time.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Licking my wounds here.
Sorry about that. Paul Sullivan is based in California, and folks want to look for your blog. It's Sully Baseball, right?
Yep, and I do my daily podcast. I'm about to upload. We've done 525 straight days with an original podcast.
Excellent.
So I've got a new one coming today.
And he's very clever, very funny, and very informed. We appreciate you being on the show, Sully.
All right, great day. Right. Hey, anytime, just let me know. Give me 2 minutes advance notice.
Okay. Sully Baseball, Paul Sullivan, and we'll get him back on the show. Herb, thanks again for being here.
Great to be here.
Yeah,
thanks.
Nice talking politics with you. Herb Smith, professor of political science at McDaniel College and author with John Willis of Maryland, Politics and Government, Democratic Dominance, a book published a couple of years ago on the history of Democratic politics in Maryland, or Maryland politics in general, by University of Nebraska Press. That's the first hour of midday. We're going to take a little break here and have an excellent lunch brought to us every Tuesday by Bagby Pizza Company in the old Bagby Furniture Building between Harbor East and Little Italy, featuring pizza, pasta, sandwiches, and salads. Carry out or dine in with indoor seating and outdoor courtyard seating. BagbyPizza.com for more information. Stay tuned for the news coming up from NPR, and then the second hour of midday.